The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Okay, we're going to go ahead and get started. I apologize for the delay. We had to wait for the pizza. Thank you all for coming, and on behalf of the Media and the Law Society and the Program on Law and Government, welcome. I'm going to very briefly introduce our panelists, and then Professor Ramil is going to moderate the panel today. Our first panelist is Emily Bazelon, who is a senior editor at Slate Magazine. She edits the assessment in the health and science sections and also covers the Supreme Court. She's worked at Legal Affairs Magazine and was a law clerk in Portland, Maine. She's a graduate of Yale College and Yale Law School. Our next panelist is Fred Barbash, who covers breaking news and analysis on WashingtonPost.com, including news about the Supreme Court and the nomination and confirmation process. Prior to that, he was the London correspondent and the national editor of the Washington Post, and he covered the Supreme Court in the 1980s. Our next panelist is Tony Morrow, who is the Supreme Court correspondent for Legal Times and American Lawyer Media. He joined American Lawyer Media in January of 2000 after covering the Supreme Court for 20 years for Gannett and USA Today. He's a graduate of Rutgers University and the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. He's the author of Illustrated Great Decisions of the Supreme Court, which was published in July 2000, and has also contributed chapters to three books about the Supreme Court. He serves on the steering committee of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press and chairs the advisory board of the National Center for Courts and Media at the National Judicial College. Our next panelist is Professor Mark Niles, who's the Associate Dean for Faculty and Academic Affairs and Professor of Law at Washington College of Law. He's a graduate of Stanford University Law School and Wesleyan University. He's a former clerk on the Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. He was an associate at Hogan & Hartson and a staff attorney for the United States Department of Justice in the Civil Appellate Division. His scholarship currently focuses on civil procedure, administrative law, constitutional law, governmental liability, and law and literature. And finally, our moderator is Professor Stephen Ramil, who's an associate professor of law and co-director of the Marshall Brennan Constitutional Literacy Project here at Washington College of Law. He's a graduate of the Washington College of Law and Tufts University, and a former Supreme Court correspondent for the Wall Street Journal and a reporter for the Boston Globe. He's currently on the editorial board for Communications Lawyer, a journal of the American Bar Association Forum on Communications Law. His scholarship focuses on Supreme Court, constitutional law, media law, First Amendment, and the life of Justice Brennan. And with that, I'll turn it over to Professor Ramil.
Thank you, Molly. Thanks for doing a great job putting this together. The Media and the Law Society really did all the work getting the speakers and putting this panel together, and we're glad to have everybody here. What I want to do is start off with a question and maybe a series of questions and kind of ask everybody to jump in, and then we'll try to leave time for you to raise questions as well. We have a lot of perspective and experience here on how the media covers the court, and so we'd like to really take advantage of that. Let me start by asking, there is from time to time, and this is sort of episodic, but I think we're probably in one of those periods where critics of the media who cover the court suggest that the media is too respectful of the court, that the way the media covers the court is, nobody goes quite so far as to say the media is in the pocket of the court, but that the media has too much reverence for the institution, doesn't do enough digging, enough questioning, does too much kind of straightforward reporting of what the court does. We can just invite anybody to jump in and kind of give us a perspective on that.
Well, I would definitely agree that we are way too deferential to the court, and I've been covering the court for 25 years. I've tried to take a somewhat different approach and regard the court as an institution where 400 people work and only 9 of them wear robes, and look at it as an institution and how how it works and how the personalities interplay. But I'll admit, I only scratched the surface in terms of the type of reporting that reporters do in other beats. And it's always mystified me why we are so deferential, because we have a sort of a unique situation at the Supreme Court where we have absolutely no access to the people we cover. In 25 years, I've probably had fewer than 25 conversations with any justice and only one on the record. And that's so different from the other, from covering the White House or the Congress. And in a sense, that ought to be liberating. We have no access in the first place. They can't punish us for controversial reporting by withdrawing access. So in a sense, that should be, that should free us from feeling like we're dependent on the court for favors. But it's still, by and large, it has been a very deferential press corps, and it's one of the ongoing mysteries.
When I was in the Supreme Court press room back in Steve's days, I should tell you that the Supreme Court is now just one of a million things I have to do. There was a time when it was the only thing I had to do. There is an institutional sense within the press room that's very different than in other press corps around Washington and around the country. It's a relatively insular press corps. The competition is not for scoops. The competition had to do with how well you explained the opinions of the court and what the court was doing. There was a certain, I felt, self-reinforcing restraint that we all felt because we were all in there together, and the judgment of our peers was probably more important than anything else other than, say, the judgment of our editors. By the same token, if you ask the question, what would we write about if we, in fact, were more aggressive and less deferential, that would be of interest and of value, then it's hard to come up with good answers. Everybody who's done research deep into the papers of the Supreme Court and the memos that go back and forth has come up with some pretty boring volumes that are of perhaps interest to a small group of practitioners but are not of great interest to the general public. The Brethren is as close as anyone's come to a bestseller, and some people say that that was essentially a distortion of what the Supreme Court did. So there hasn't been a scandal that would make the front page out of the Supreme Court since I can't even say when there was a scandal.
Abe Fortas.
And that wasn't a court scandal. That was an Abe Fortas scandal. It had nothing, had almost nothing to do with the functioning of the Supreme Court. So, and my last word will be that in some ways it's good that we don't, you can call it reverence or whatever. First of all, I think the Supreme Court is something that is better than other institutions of government, and I don't mind admiring it. And second of all, the inability to penetrate the court and do the kind of aggressive reporting that, or what passes for aggressive reporting on every beat, and I've covered all three branches of government, forces us to deal with substance as opposed to process. When I covered the White House, all we cared about was who leaked what to whom, which aide was saying what to which other aide, who was up and who was down, and none of that had anything to do with the actual policy, or very little to do with the actual policy that was made at the White House. I'm not sure that it would be very useful for the general public to know what Justice O'Connor said to Justice Souter on any particular day about a particular footnote. In fact, I think it would bore everybody silly. So I'm kind of resigned to the way it is and don't really mind it and don't feel historically that we've missed any big stories over there by being, quote, reverential.
I'm the newcomer to this world. I just started covering the court last spring, so I want to make sure not to say things that are hugely wrong, and I hope that my more experienced colleagues will correct me. But I think One thing I've thought of a lot about is what we mean by deferential, and it seems though as though there are at least two different meanings. There's the kind of lack of digging and investigative reporting that Fred and Tony were talking about, and then there's tone deference. And the first kind of deference, I think I'm sort of somewhere between Tony and Fred on. It seems to me that the kinds of stories that would probably make the front page about justices struggling over how to decide a big case like affirmative action case or something of that nature where there's a fifth vote and it's going back and forth. One good example are the sentencing reform cases from last year where there were these two decisions going in opposite ways and Ruth Bader Ginsburg was the only person joining both decisions and she never wrote anything. And it was really hard to come up with a kind of intellectually coherent way to make those two decisions come together. And so, yeah, if one could have gotten into her chambers and had a sense of what she was thinking and why she did what she did, I think people would have been interested in that. But it's virtually impossible to do that sort of reporting. The court has always, the justices have always cared a great deal about the sort of confidentiality and security of their chambers, and the publication of the book Closed Chambers by Ed Lazarus several years ago made them even more cognizant of those issues. So I do think in some ways the fact that it's so hard to do is liberating and does push the coverage toward the substance that Fred was talking about. But and now I'm sort of speaking as the upstart member of the web-based journalism up here, but at Slate, my colleague Dahlia Lithwick started several years ago to cover the court in a different way by changing the tone that she was writing in, and you know, I'm sure some of you have read her pieces. She comes back and she reports from the court, and it's like you were going to a boxing match or a sporting event, and it's much more about the give and take, and there's no effort. There's no assumption that the justices are worthy of a great deal of respect and can't be treated like anybody else, asking smart or dumb or, you know, silly questions or cracking jokes. And I've really enjoyed kind of following in Dahlia's footsteps because it seems to me that that's a way to make people more interested in what's actually happening in argument and to kind of bring in, I hope, readers like you who care about the law, one hopes, to some degree, but also readers who have no legal training whatsoever. And so if there was I wonder, here's, I'll sort of end with a question, I wonder if the more kind of mainstream journalism outlets, like major newspapers, will ever change their coverage to move in that direction. And I think that there's an opportunity for them to do that now that there wasn't before because of the new news cycle that we're all operating in. You know, even by the time I finish writing at 4 or if I'm lucky 3 o'clock after argument, there have already been multiple blogs that have, and not to mention the radio, that have told people the basic facts of how a decision came down. You know, if the decision is announced at 10 or if argument is over at 11, by 12, that news is out. And so the newspapers the next morning don't really need to cover that news anymore. They could, if they wanted, take a different approach. And so I think it'll be really interesting to see if that way of covering the court changes in the next few years.
I'm the only person up here who's never been a journalist. I think the way that I come to this is in two ways, really. One is an administrative law professor and scholar where I spend a fair amount of time looking at sort of the structures of government and separation of powers and sort of appropriate roles of government in different areas. And second, as a pop culture scholar and professor who spends a lot of time looking at the way media depicts legal structures and sort of what that means for our society in positive and negative ways. And I guess the administrative law professor part of me would respond to the sort of even the question is saying that maybe there's a substantive sort of valid reason for treating the court differently within our governmental structure than other parts of the government because it is at least ostensibly the non-political branch of government. And therefore, there's a different scope of issues and questions that maybe are appropriate to address in covering the court. It's very appropriate to talk about the influence of lobbyists and other sort of political influences on people in Congress. There's lots and lots of issues that come up in terms of decisions that congressional people or the executive branch people make based on their political influences. But maybe, at least arguably, the court is a different sort of entity and a different sort of model and a different sort of governmental structure, and therefore there's less of a need, as you suggest, to talk about the back and forth in the rooms between the people and more just of a focus on actually what they're doing substantively. And I say that very much tongue-in-cheek because obviously it's not so separated from politics in that way, and I think that's, but I guess one thing that I would say leading into my sort of second category of observations is that maybe to a certain extent the media is accepting that traditional notion of the non-political nature of the court, and that's part of why it sort of has less of a critical or less of a focused analysis. And just in terms of sort of accepting the premise and maybe explaining some reasons why from sort of a media sort of critics or media observation standpoint, I think one thing, I think the Supreme Court is still much cleaner in terms of its history than much of the rest of the government. I think people, certainly in my generation and my parents' generation, experienced a great deal of discontent about the nature of our governmental structures as it related to both the Congress and the executive branch through various scandals and other things that happened. And I think to a great extent, as I think Tony mentioned, or maybe Fred, Tony or Fred, that we really haven't had scandals like that relating to the court. Justice Fortas's concerns was potentially a scandal, but nothing to the level of other things that happen. And I think that part of why the court receives its relatively lax treatment to the extent that it does is it isn't perceived as sort of having transgressed in a way that other branches do. I also think that the relatively soft treatment of the court to the extent that there is some doesn't transfer to the rest of our judicial system. I think obviously the media has become a very sort of aggressive and focused critic of the judicial system. I remember just last week there was a big picture on the local news of some judge who had let some guy go, ended up doing some bad things to people, and they basically had his address and a map to his house and sort of how to build flyers and stuff and other ways to sort of go after him in a way that maybe you wouldn't have seen 10 or 15 years ago. I think the big difference is you don't have cameras in the court, and I think that makes a very big difference in terms of the relative austere nature and sort of the respect that the court has given. Professor Romeil and I have talked about this a great deal in terms of the appropriateness of cameras in the Supreme Court. I think one of the reasons not to do it is because having the cameras there, I think, would very much undercut this notion of this court being sort of a light on a hill and sort of untouchable in the sense, I think, if you really saw it. And I think what Dia Litwick has done, and I've read some of it, and I think it's great, is really to undercut some of that sort of austere nature and treat these people as regular human beings as opposed to people who are untouchable. In terms of stuff that the court, that the press could do that they don't already do, I guess there are two things that jumped to my mind. I think they, and maybe they were, and maybe I wasn't paying attention, but I think they could have been a little bit more critical of sort of the political influences in the Bush v. Gore decision. Obviously, a lot of law professors and people talked about that. I think questioning of sort of the appropriateness of the court stepping in at that point under the circumstances and inconsistencies with some of the conservative justices' views of stepping into state court decisions could have been made more focused. I wonder if the country was just so fatigued at that point that it didn't seem like sort of a valid thing. And I guess personally, or maybe it's personally, a little bit more focus on the whole Scalia-Cheney duck hunting thing. I think that's the kind of thing that the people could have maybe focused on, and sort of the broad public could have focused on in a way that some of these stories would be a little bit oblique. And I heard a lot of law professors talking about it, but I didn't see a lot of coverage of it in the mainstream press. And maybe that would be something that would justify some sort of investigative reporting. What was going on there? Let me try to get some witnesses and some people who were on the duck hunting trip to see if they can talk about some stuff that hasn't come out in the media. And this would seem like a legitimate news story. And again, I don't know for sure, but I didn't feel like it was covered sort of as much. And maybe it's part because Justice Scalia is treated differently than an executive branch official might have been, given their sense of his unpolitical nature. And I think maybe the press could do more in that vein.
These comments raise a lot of different things to think about. On the coverage of the Scalia-Cheney thing, I think the Los Angeles Times was really the only institution that put huge amount of effort into it, if I'm not mistaken. Tony, correct me if I'm wrong. But I guess these questions sort of make me wonder a little bit what is the purpose of press coverage of the Supreme Court? Is press coverage of the Supreme Court intended to demystify the institution? Is it simply intended to convey in a straightforward manner the work product of the court, or is there something else? Is it, should it be trying to portray the weaknesses or foibles or other problems with the institution? What are you trying to accomplish?
Well, I mean, it seems to me that we're trying to do all of those things, and sometimes some of them more than others. And then the problem is always, well, you know that you should really be focusing more resources on the problems and foibles of the court until it's too late, or until the moment is past. I mean, a lot of the reporting about internal workings of the court come from the papers of the justices that tend to be released after their deaths, and so then you find out, you know, 10 years after Planned Parenthood versus Casey that O'Connor never really planned to join the opinion striking down Roe, even though everyone thought at the time that was where she was leaning. So I think that the straightforward explanation is a really important part of what the press should be doing right. And when the press gets it wrong, and that was one problem just in the very initial moments after the Bush versus Gore decision was handed down, that decision wasn't reported out quite accurately, and that matters. It's also what happens when you have 5 minutes to look at something before you go on camera. So
it was really bad.
And it was... So I think that just sort of getting it right is really important, clearly, and that a lot of the issues being decided are complicated, and so getting the nuance right and, all the things that the people up here do a really good job doing and work really hard at, making sure they understand what's at stake in a case and how to best get that across so that people who don't have their whole day to spend studying it will understand that. That's big. I think Americans tend to have a sort of ambivalent relationship toward demystifying generally any branch of government, and then maybe are particularly uncomfortable about the court because it is supposed to be removed from at least electoral politics. And so that's a tension that I think will always be there, and some of us will fall more on one side of that tension than others, and that's probably a good thing. We probably want to have that going in both directions so that people get a range of coverage, and it really depends what people are looking for.
A couple of quick thoughts. Reporters are nothing if not venal and ambitious, like a dog looking for red meat. They will go where it is. If there were a hint of something at the Supreme Court for somebody to bite into, I guarantee you we would swarm all over it. The fact of the matter is that there isn't that smell there. Second thing, I don't know what foibles it is that people are talking about. I don't know what demystification means. Supreme Court is the single most, Tony's going to quarrel with me about use of the term, the single most open branch of government in this respect. It's the only branch of government that argues about what it's doing in public, okay? Without the benefit of aides and staff members scurrying around behind them while they're arguing about it, and I'm talking about the oral argument, telling them what to say and how to say it. B, the Supreme Court is the only institution of government that feels compelled to explain why it's doing what it's doing at length, at enormous length. And when one of them disagrees, they'll tell you about it, and they'll explain why. Third, the Supreme Court is the only institution of government that will entertain arguments from people of any level of society and take them, frankly, equally seriously, as many of the landmark decisions of that court reflect. In that respect, you cannot penetrate the United States Congress that way without an army of lobbyists and a $100 million budget, believe me. So when we talk about demystifying the court, to me what that means is simply explaining to people better what they're doing, when they're doing. There's a lot of misinformation out there. You see it when in the United States Senate when they hold confirmation hearings and people think that a decision like Kelo is somehow usurping a legislative prerogative. When senators use terms like your decision having to do with pedophiles, I believe that was Senator Brownback. They don't have the vaguest idea what the court's done, and the public sees only about, as far as the general public is concerned, they think the court deals with one subject, and that's abortion, and then spends the rest of its time trying to figure out ways to let criminals off the hook. I mean, if you go, I'd go home to Wisconsin, and the things, when I was full-time covering the court, the kind of things very otherwise intelligent people think the Supreme Court does, and it shows up in these confirmation hearings. That's they obsess over the things that they think their constituents care about, and what's that? Roe against Wade, and the occasional flag-burning case, okay? So I think where we're really failing as a profession is in our inability to get across to the public what the nature of the court's work and the breadth of the court's work and how they make their decisions, which is very, very difficult to explain clearly, to be sure, but we could all be doing a better job of that.
Before Tony responds, I just want to tell one quick story, which was when Fred and Tony and I all started covering the court, there was a public information officer whose probably most famous line ever was that the Supreme Court was a goldfish bowl. You could see everything that was going on inside the goldfish bowl. And so for a time in the late 80s, we bought a plastic goldfish bowl, and anytime anybody was leaving the Supreme Court press corps, we gave them the goldfish bowl as a going-away present to symbolize this line. But Tony, you want to respond?
Well, sure. I mean, the problem with that is I'm mangling your metaphor, but you have to be in the room to see the goldfish bowl. This very open institution is, because it doesn't allow cameras in the court, is only visible to the 300 people, 200 people who can see it in the courtroom, who can be in the courtroom. I don't think that's the characteristic of an open institution anymore. I mean, not to dwell solely on the camera issue, but I think it's their reluctance to allow cameras is part of the overall culture of the Supreme Court, which is a culture of secrecy. There's a political scientist, Barbara Perry, who has said quite openly that she thinks that part of the reason the American public respects the Supreme Court so much is because it's invisible, and that somehow invisibility is part of the court's mystique, a necessary part of the court's mystique, and if you think that through, that's almost saying familiarity breeds contempt. The more that we would know about the court, the less we would like it. And I just don't think that's a tenable argument in a democratic society. That sounds more like a Stalinist view or something, that somehow the majesty of the institution depends on its on it being unknown to the people who it affects. And so I think that's just been my criticism, and you just see it in a lot of different ways. And I'll just tell one little anecdote. Whenever a new justice comes onto the Supreme Court, the press corps holds a little reception for wine and cheese reception for the justice in the press room. And we're doing it for the Chief Justice Roberts in a few weeks, actually. But I remember distinctly the one where Justice Souter came onto the court. He's a fairly reticent guy. Hermit might be going too far, but that's close. But he was very polite during our little reception, talked to us for a couple of hours, but then you could kind of see him backing out the door. And as he was about to leave, he said to us, this was a lot of fun. Let's do this again when I retire. And it really brought home the idea that, you know, you see a lot of these justices when they're up for confirmation, and then maybe at the when they retire, they might have a press conference. But in the middle, when they're doing the public's work, they're invisible.
I would not argue with the need to, that I would not argue with the proposition that the court's oral arguments ought to be televised. I think that's what prohibition is absurd.
Just to pick up on that, I want to say a little bit about that, and then something in response to what reporters should do or what the role should be. I remember after the O.J. Simpson trial, there was a lot of discussion from people or arguments from people saying, "See, that's why we don't have cameras in courtrooms, because if you did, they'd see all that nightmare stuff going on that everybody got so upset about." And the whole notion that watching the trial and watching sort of the apparent ineptitude of the prosecution and sort of the disarray that the judge couldn't seem to control is the reason why we don't want to demonstrate it. And I think Tony is absolutely right. There's two responses to that. One is, well, I hope every trial isn't like that, because if it is, we're in a lot of trouble. And two, if it is like that, then maybe demonstrating that it's like that will lead to reform and to changes that will sort of make the system work better. I also agree with Tony that that would not be the impact if there was televising of Supreme Court arguments or of Court of Appeals arguments. I clerked in the Court of Appeals. I've seen lots of these. They're actually remarkably positive 90% of the time in terms of what they demonstrate about the way our legal system works. In fact, as I tell my students, the way that the legal system is depicted in sort of fiction is often very misleading in terms of the way it actually is, in terms of the professionalism of lawyers. Like, one of the biggest surprises that people have when they actually start practicing is how professional and sort of respectful and responsible attorneys really are. And I think you see that really well in Supreme Court arguments and other appellate arguments. I think it would be a wonderful benefit to our society to show it, and it's very unfortunate. But I do think the main reason not to do it is to create this sense of austerity, which would be undermined if people saw these things over and over again. And maybe there'd be other ways to keep that austerity up. In terms of what reporters can do, I think the role of reporters in our society in a democracy basically is to provide people who don't have enough time to do it with information that they would want to have if they did have enough time to investigate it and figure it out for themselves. Basically, in order for them to make reasoned and informed decisions in a democracy, but also for broader reasons. So what should reporters do as it relates to the Supreme Court? Provide information that is information people don't otherwise have that they would like to have. And I'd like to note what I saw, and it rarely happens to me, as a very extremely positive press moment. I don't remember the guy's first name, but he's a political reporter for ABC News. I think his last name is Halperin. He did what I thought was an excellent piece on these commercials about John Roberts, about the abortion clinic issue and stuff. And he did a wonderful piece where he basically said these things are misleading. It's not he said, she said. It's not, well, the people who made the commercials say this, but the people who don't like the commercials say this, and sort of throwing up your hands, I don't know, and which is generally, I think, the way the press covers too many of these stories. He made a very pointed statement to say, look, this is why this is factually misleading. You, person sitting in your house watching this commercial after the commercial's over, might look at it and say, wow, John Roberts looks like a pretty bad guy because of this. Well, maybe he is a bad guy, maybe he isn't, but this particular commercial was misleading factually, and I thought he did a very good job of focusing on that. My only question is, why wasn't there similar reporting of other sorts of things that were misleading in prior elections and other things, and I don't really know why there wasn't. I saw that as a very good but exceptional example of the kind of things that reporters can do in terms of providing information that people wouldn't otherwise have. Most people aren't going to know what really happened and the real connections between the cases that were involved in that and the actual abortion clinic bombings and all those things. And I think the press does an excellent service for the American people when it comes in and doesn't just report what one side is saying and then report what the other side is saying, but comes in and says, you know, what this side is saying isn't supported by the facts, and here's why it's not supported by the facts.
Mentioning the O.J. Simpson trial touches on something else I wanted to ask about. The O.J. Simpson trial is remembered for a number of things, but one of them is the circus atmosphere. But what is forgotten, I think, is that the circus atmosphere was really outside the courtroom. There was really only one camera inside the courtroom. And presumably that would be the case if there were cameras in the Supreme Court chamber. But I want to ask about outside the Supreme Court chamber. How much spin goes on? How much has it increased? How much are you, as reporters covering the court, getting contacted by groups saying, you know, hey, I want to talk about today's decision. Hey, I want to talk about the significance of this case. Emily, do you get that kind of effort. Tony, I'm sure you do too.
I get lots and lots of emails. You guys probably get those emails too. I don't think they're very effective. I don't think they matter very much. I think reporters tend to be perhaps too suspicious of anything that comes and tries to find them. We like to feel like we went out and found the story, even if it's just reading the brief. We want to read our own brief. That tends to be, or at least that's certainly my bias. And so I feel like people can email me all day, and maybe I'll read them and maybe I won't, but the chances that it's really going to shape my coverage are small. I think that the web has become a fabulous tool for interest groups to get materials together. So if they can get you interested, then all the background is very easy for you to find and to write there, and I appreciate that a lot. So, for example, there was a group, and I don't even remember what they're called, that was trying to get a bunch of people's attention about a piece of legislation called the Streamline Procedures Act that, if the Senate Judiciary Committee ever gets around to doing anything involving a law this fall, supposedly it's supposed to have hearings. And they were able to email me and say, here's this law, and if you go to this website, like, here are all these statements. Here's the judicial conference talking about why this law is a bad idea. And that, I think, is quite useful. But I don't really, when I went to that website, I didn't read the advocacy statements. I wanted to look at the text of the law, and, you know, maybe I was interested in what the judicial conference has to say because they have some official status. I think that the interest groups are trying really hard, and one of the things that's been really striking to me as a member of the Supreme Court press is to realize how much power we have, because people want, there's a narrow channel for getting out all this, all these views that people have. But I think it's pretty easy for reporters to cut through it. I'd be curious about what Fred and Tony think.
Well, it really has been a dramatic change. I mean, you know, when we started in covering the court, it was like pulling teeth to get lawyers to talk to you about a case, or, you know, they'd say, call me back next week when I receive the decision in the mail. and now it's just instantaneous. But it's more than that. There's really, I get PR people for law firms trying to interest me in their pending petition, or they'll say, you know, this abortion case is coming up, and we have a member of our firm or a member of our law school faculty who can talk about it. I welcome those. Some of my colleagues don't. Is that lobbying? Is it just spin? I think it's a little bit of both. And one thing at Legal Times we write a column that looks ahead at future conferences of the court, where the court is looking at petitions that are in the pipeline to see if they're going to grant or deny. It's kind of forecasting the unpredictable, but what has happened lately is I get calls from lawyers who want me to feature their case in that column, as if the Supreme Court justices are going to read Legal Times and say, oh, gee, I think we ought to take that case. And I mentioned that facetiously once to one of the lawyers who said that, but he said, well, no, but the law clerks are reading Legal Times, and if they see that a case is gaining attention, then they might recommend it in a certain way. I think that overstates it, but it shows you the extent to which lobbying and spin has come to the Supreme Court.
I hear mostly, you know, all the big law firms have public relations firms working for them now, and most of the calls that I get are law firms who want some mention as having handled a particular case, or one of their people as having argued a particular case, or they want somebody who's expert in the subject matter to comment on the case, and they want to be sure that you mention the full name of the firm in the story, and I understand that. It brings some attention to the firm. The industry lobbies tries to spin, but, you know, it's so different than the other parts of government because, they know on the whole that it's kind of futile. It's productive for them in the sense that the issue before the court is part of some wider controversy. that may ultimately have originated in the Congress or in a state legislature, or is just generally something they want people to have particular attitudes about. And in that sense, it is more like conventional spinning or lobbying. Generally, what they tell you before the case is decided, it's if they lose this case, the world will come to an end. And after they lose the case, they call up to tell you it didn't really matter. It was a really limited opinion, and pay no attention to what the court did today. It has no impact on our industry.
The government seems to do a good job of that, too. I think we all always enjoyed reading Solicitor General's briefs that said, you know, if you need to grant this case because there are 300 other cases like it around the country, and the total cost to the government will be $10 million if the government loses this case. And then when you reported that because the government lost the case, the Solicitor General's office would call up and say, what are you talking about? You know, where'd you get that idea?
Well, that raises an interesting area of coverage that we don't really go after the arguments that are made, not so much the arguments of the law, but the arguments particularly in the government's petitions or friend of the court briefs, in which they do in fact claim that the United States will never ever be able to fight a war again if you do X or if you do Y, or that 50,000 people will be put out of work. And you know, there's an area probably for some productive and this stuff does show up in the footnotes. It's not it often is cited by the court in footnote to help explain things as to why a particular something might be disruptive or why a state has an interest in something. And a lot of it is just made up, basically. A lot of the stuff is just, you know, what you can do with statistics, and nobody's actually checking to see if there's any basis to what the litigants are claiming in those things. So that actually raises an interesting something to work on.
There are two more things. I have lots more questions, but there are two things I think we need to accomplish before we run out of time. One is to leave time for your questions, and two is that I know everybody will want to know how this panel feels the coverage of Roberts and Myers has been. So let's start there.
I think the coverage of Roberts and Myers has sort of followed the reaction of the senators and the sort of inside the Beltway forces to Roberts and Myers. And so Roberts got fairly deferential coverage, and Myers is getting creamed. But I don't think that the press is creaming Myers. I mean, when Arlen Specter and Senator Leahy hold a press conference expressing clear irritation for her with the answers that she submitted to the Judiciary Committee, what else is going to happen? You know, I do think that the storylines that develop about nominees have this kind of momentum of their own. And so then the details about the nominees that get picked up and carried along and given a lot of tension tend to be the details that either confirm these kind of initial impressions or really, really go against them. And so the initial impression of Roberts was that he was this, you know, fabulous Supreme Court lawyer and this brilliant guy. And so we heard a lot about, you know, the acumen with which he had written his 1980s memos for the Justice Department, and the praise of him from, you know, people on the right and the left was about how he was one of the top advocates for the Supreme Court. And though that resonated with the Roberts storyline, and so that was sort of what went forward. And by the time something I thought mattered. By the time that the White House kind of started releasing this trickle of documents from the 80s that really had material in it about his views on abortion, for example, since that is obviously the big hot button, those things almost didn't matter that much. It was like, if they had been there initially, they might have mattered quite a lot, but the moment was lost. And yes, he had signed this brief in Russ versus Sullivan, calling for the overturn of Roe versus Wade, but he explained that as, you know, his job as part of the SG's office at the time, and everyone accepted that. And I think what's happened with Myers is that the start out of the gate was so poorly done that what's coming up are all the mistakes being made. And that also the sort of glory of Myers, of course, was supposed to be that she didn't have any written record, and so no one was going to be able to pin her down. Well, that's actually turned out to be a big problem, because if you're me, and a lot of people in the press corps, you get really frustrated if you can't write about substance. I was furious that she was a choice, not because I don't like her or can't, just because the things I like to write about, I like to go back and read people's opinions and look at their legal views. There was nothing there. And so what's kind of amplifying in that echo chamber are the mistakes. Like, she didn't file her bar application, and she apparently didn't do so well as what the senators wanted her to do on this questionnaire. And, you know, Arlen Specter thought she'd endorse Griswold, and no, now she says she hasn't. So that's, I think, played to her disadvantage in a way that I imagine the administration didn't anticipate. But I would be curious about what you all think about the press coverage. It's always really hard when you're on the inside of it to know how good a job we're doing.
On the Roberts thing, I did fault us, including my own paper, in treating some of those documents because we didn't provide the context for the circumstances under which those things were generated, so that you didn't get any sense of understanding about the Reagan administration, and of course most of you were not around for that, and many of our readers were not around for that, and some of us were around for that, and some of the newspapers treated some of these memos in which he deplored the so-called right to privacy, as he put it, and affirmative action, in which he deplored that, as if they were sort of war crimes. Got him, he said this. Well, that was mainstream Reagan administration rhetoric up to a point. He may have been a little more to the right than some of the people in the Reagan administration, probably a little bit to the left. But there wasn't much, because I was there for those wars, I was kind of disturbed by the writing about them in a vacuum, and the biases of the writers showed up. A lot of the writers showed up in the treatment of perfectly routine points of view about things like affirmative action and Roe against Wade, treating them like they were somehow outrageous or scandalous or was going to get him in trouble in one way or the other. The whole process of covering this is just really distorted by the unwillingness of the nominees to say anything, and the justice of their of that position in light of the fact that members of the Judiciary Committee and the constituency groups and the interest groups will shred them in the event they do say anything. And that's what really concerns me about the whole confirmation process, is that it's reached a point where, in fact, it is in the interest of the nominee to keep their mouth shut. In the case of Harriet Myers, she will benefit from what we've done to her when she testifies, if in fact she can sort of get a C out of it.
Yeah.
Because everyone's expecting an F. If there's anything lower than an F these days, I don't know. Everyone's expecting such a catastrophic performance that if in fact she comes off sounding semi-literate, she's going to get a lot of good press. Well, that wasn't so bad.
It's a page from her boss's model.
Yeah, exactly.
No expectations.
Right. Well, just want to, I want to get to questions, but just a quick observation. I think Emily is exactly right that the storyline was set on John Roberts before those, controversial memos came out. And so they didn't kind of change the storyline. But I just wonder the extent to which the storyline was set, the favorable storyline on John Roberts, had to do with the fact that he was so well known to those of us who cover the Supreme Court. This is the first time in a very long time that a justice, especially a chief justice, comes to the bench with a press corps that many of whose members know him by the first name. I just raised that as a question. I don't know if that matters, but I think part of the reaction to Harry Myers, by contrast, has been the fact that nobody does know her, not just the press corps, but Jeffrey Stone from the University of Chicago wrote a column opposing Harriet Myers, and one of the big points he made was, I've been teaching constitutional law for 30 years, and I never heard of Harriet Myers. as if somehow that was a qualification for being a justice. But
well, the thing is, the coverage shifts. If you watch the bylines carefully, you notice the coverage tends not to be by the Supreme Court writer of a confirmation. Supreme Court
in the major
newspapers, because the coverage, you know, we're very turf oriented. And when I covered the court, when something came over there, I wasn't going to let anybody in from the rest of the paper, including somebody. If it was an education case, it was the Education Report. So now this is on the Hill, and the Hill reporters, again, at the large papers that have these creatures, these beats, the Hill reporter is going to have Barbash coming around and stepping into the con, saying, "Oh, step aside, you'll never understand this. You know, I know this guy and I know this subject." So if you actually look at the bylines, at least in the big papers, you'll see that and it probably the networks, it tends not to be the same people doing the confirmation process as are doing the court itself. And I think Tony's an exception, one of the exceptions there, but I bet it wasn't like that when you were, you know. Yeah.
I thought a lot about this one before this, and because I was trying to think of some bad stuff to say about the press coverage, because I thought maybe that's part of what I should do. But I have to say, it's hard to come up with, from my perspective, a lot of negative things to say about the way the press covered Roberts or Myers, or is covering Myers. It's large part because of Emily's point, which I also think is exactly right. I think to a great extent the press follows the way that Congress and the Senate in particular sets up the structure. When you think about the Thomas hearings, I don't remember the Thomas hearings as becoming what they became because of the press. I think they became what they became because of what the senators and their staffers were doing, what was going on behind the scenes in Congress. And I think the press actually did a great job of doing a large part of what the press should do, which is to put a window on it and let the American people watch it and sort of make decisions on their own. To a great extent, I think that's what they did there, what they do here in relationship to this to a great extent. So I think they're responsive in a positive way. Another thing, I think often the press sort of confines issues in a way that I think is detrimental, because things are generally more complicated than the mainstream press wants to explain them. But actually, I kind of think this is an instance where the press's sort of simplification of these issues is productive. I think a lot of the sort of the public interest groups and other groups out there fighting the confirmation get away from the basic point, which is that the president gets to nominate pretty much who the president wants to nominate. And the question is this person going to get confirmed? And the rest of the discussion is interesting, but I feel like the press seems to focus on that aspect of it, and I think very much positively, because I think that's ultimately the question. And outside of constitutional law professors and other people, that's basically what the focus is. So I think the way that they push that focus is really good. The only other thing I would say is I was talking to some friends who were commenting on the press's coverage of Roberts being sort of oddly sensual almost. That people were talking about his deep blue eyes and how attractive he was.
Little boy.
In a way that was kind of a little sort of icky to people. But in a way that seemed more like you would expect to see coverage of maybe in our society in terms of gender issues of a woman as opposed to a man. He was sort of dreamy in a sense, and that that led me to think of, I remember when Oliver North, the whole Oliver North thing happened, and again the press was just sort of putting a camera on the guy, but the guy was sort of very charismatic and compelling, and the fact that he was sort of personally compelling to many people I think really changed the nature of the story. But again, I don't think that's the press's fault so much as that's just sometimes what happens. So the fact that Roberts was really compelling sitting there and seemed like a really compelling guy, I think wasn't the press's fault, it just what happened. And I really agree completely that the expectations are so low for Harriet Myers now. If she can say the word Constitution when she's in her hearing, I think she's going to be sort of on top of the sort of process. So we'll see how that goes in that way.
Okay, I want to leave time for questions. So we're going to take 30 seconds and do this. Yes, no, too soon to tell, or I don't want to answer. Will Harriet Myers be confirmed?
Do I have to go first?
No, you can go first. All the other
Steve time. Was looking. You go ahead.
Yes.
No.
No.
I hate being wrong, so I hate making predictions. I thought absolutely until this morning, and now I'm wavering.
No, nobody remembers the bad predictions anyway.
So. And we're not on camera.
I'll cop out and say too soon to tell. All right, how about your question?
Someone alluded to just maybe the role of clerks and knowledge, we didn't really know a lot about the whole like clerk-judge relationship, but has there ever been any coverage, or do you guys concentrate on the clerks in the process itself?
Anybody want
to
take a crack at
When I was at USA Today, I did a what was then the biggest story that USA Today, or the longest package of stories that USA Today had ever printed on the influence of the law clerks, and also on the lack of diversity among the law clerks. We did the first sort of demographic look at the law clerks, and so there has been attention paid, but it's always, it's hard to really quantify the influence of the law clerks. The clerks themselves either vastly overstate or vastly understate their influence, and it's hard to get it right.
Sometimes, but
yeah.
And the other thing about the clerks is now they're like practically have to sign in blood that they will not speak to the press while they are there. So, like, my best friend from law school basically didn't talk to me the whole day, even about other things.
Yeah, in the back.
Considering that we're all in law schools and in Washington, D.C., we're in a minority of people in the United States who actually know a substantial amount about the Supreme Court and the issues that they cover. And a lot of people, you know, they see the Michael Jackson case, see the Abuse Simpson case, the Anna Nicole Smith case. You know, it's very alluring to them to pay attention to those things. And, but do you feel like the media coverage has given those issues overshadowed, you know, more substantive issues that the Supreme Court is dealing with?
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, that's the entertainment aspect. We would have written about that case, probably. Maybe I'm wrong, but for Anna Nicole Smith, I don't know. But yeah, it does, and that just goes with the territory. Most people in the country are not interested in the court or in the courts, the Supreme Court, or any court. So help them God. And nor do they necessarily need to be interested in it. They're interested in cases from time to time. But the notion, I was in a seminar the other day of why can't we get people interested in the court system? And, people got better things to do than worry about whether the judicial conference ought to be doing this, that, or the other thing, or whether there ought to be more, judges ought to be paid more or less. And there is a serious issue having to do with, attacks on judges.
I just found it surprising that a small percentage of our American public knew that the Supreme Court decided who our president was in the 2001 election. When I read a book on it in undergrad and I was talking to my friend about it, they were like, what?
They didn't know about the case?
Well, they knew about the case, but they had no idea that the election was decided. And then talking to my family and talking to other people, random people, I think it's shocking that so many people...
Now, did they not know, or did they just didn't agree with you?
I don't think
the Supreme Court decided the election?
I don't think they knew.
Okay.
I think as long as the mainstream media is primarily for profit, that it's run by for profit entities, you're going to get information from the media which is more tilted towards what they believe people want to know about as opposed to what people arguably need to know about. And I think a lot of reporters, and to a certain extent to their credit, are reluctant to feel like they are the ones to decide exactly what people need to know about as opposed to whatever. But I personally think there's far too much, and for me this is obvious, there's far too much reporting throughout all of the mainstream media, not just in legal issues, about things which really aren't of particular importance broadly to the nation, but are particularly interesting to people, whether it's a story about one missing kid who's become sort of the celebrity missing kid when we have a society of child abuse and other kids are having issues. So I think it's a much broader question about the media, but I think the answer is the way our media is structured, as long as it's run by these corporations that are looking at the bottom line, we're going to get, to a certain extent, much more entertainment than we're going to get substance. And I don't think that's an attack on specific media people, but I think it's it's a problem with part of our media. And that said, we have public media and we have other things. I think newspapers are less tied to this, because I think if you spend the time to read the newspaper, then you will get a lot of this useful information. I think it's really television that has that major flaw. And I think if we rely on television to give us information, we're all in a lot of trouble.
In front of the last question.
Well, I guess I should have said yesterday, but I just didn't quite realize it until I saw the way it was reported that happened. I mean, I think that this press conference with Lay and Spector was really a pro- it was a big embarrassment for her. It was a bipartisan embarrassment. I'm not exactly sure what, like, for Arlen Spector to go after her like that. I mean, has he just decided he doesn't care at all what the administration thinks because everyone's so caught up in whether Karl Rove is going to be indicted or not that, you know, no one is manning the ship at all, or what? And so for him to take that, or was he just so annoyed by this whole like back and forth with Griswold that he's and I guess the other thing was that there had been reports earlier that the lawyers on the Senate Judiciary Committee were opposing the nomination because they just felt like she didn't know what she was doing. And now it seems like they're not just sort of, you know, grumbling off the record. They're really going after her. And that made me wonder what really is going to happen during these hearings. I'm much more curious than I was before.
It's not about her anymore. It's about Bush. And if you talk privately to senators, the thoughtful senators, they believe the president is toying with the United States Supreme Court. And that's where this mystification and the reverence comes in. Again, serious senators like Leahy and like Spector. It's the administration's, not just the submission of her name in the first instance, which is an arguable thing, but what's happened since. And there is a real sense of disgust. And I'm merely relating to you what I hear from responsible members of the Senate as opposed to irresponsible members, people who care about the court and its and the integrity of the in the functioning of the institution. And that's why, that's one of the reasons I think this could go down.
So I mean, one small measure of this was that Roberts' nomination, so the day that Roberts was announced, the whole press corps was told that Edith Clement was the nominee that day. I wrote a whole piece about Edith Clement and still consider about this. And then I
maybe you can use it again in about 2 months.
I don't think so. Apparently she made, I don't know. But yeah, I thought about this. And then, so I was getting calls from, I was doing some television and radio that day, and at about 7:30 I was being interviewed and by Nightline, and the Nightline people came on, and it was Roberts. And this is 7:30 p.m., and so I actually just accidentally had read the decision in Hamdan, which was the executive power Guantanamo Bay case, that Roberts hadn't written that decision, but he had signed onto it. I had happened to have read it the day before, and so I actually had something I wanted to say about Roberts. But on television that night, nobody knew anything about John Roberts. People were just reading his resume, and his resume is great. And so that night and the next morning, the coverage about Roberts was entirely positive. And the White House planned the whole thing. They had lined up the people to be on television. They had lined up the friends and colleagues of John Roberts, who the reporter scrambling around called. And that set the tone for the whole thing that followed. Myers was nominated at 8 a.m. on a Monday morning. And nobody was lined up except for Nathan Hecht.
Yeah, Mr. Hecht,
kind of like,
the wonderful Mr.
Hecht. You know,
Hecht.
Who's really quite, I mean, there's a lot to say, but he's a real evangelical pro-lifer. I mean, his record on the Texas Supreme Court is very clear in that way. And so there was a whole day for people to get going and find lots of people to talk to and, you know, notice all the things that she hasn't done. So just that decision about that mere scheduling decision and the lack of homework that had been done to prep the right, whereas Roberts, they had been talking to Roberts to the right for a year in advance. So it does sort of have this feeling of like just serious mismanagement, and it's hard not to attribute that to the White House.
Let's take one more. I think there's a class waiting to get in here. So
just sort of piggybacking on what you just said and how earlier you all had said that you really look to the elected officials to sort of set the tone for your coverage of the Supreme Court. I've actually worked for an elected official in media management. What do you feel is your responsibility to expand the debate beyond, I mean, just like you're saying, how the timing of it and the prepackaged story is sitting there waiting for you for the first 2 days to be positive for Roberts. you know, what is your responsibility to look outside that prepackaged story and to expand the debate on the issues other than abortion and that kind of thing?
We have a serious response. Yeah. I mean that's where aggressive reporting is necessary.
We should be changing the storyline to the extent that, you know, there are other things to report. But in that first hour, it's very hard. I mean, you know what you know at that moment.
Tony, you want the last word?
No, I'm fine. Thank you.
All right. Thank you to the panelists.